Good morning. Emin just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aras, this morning and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary in her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aras and Emin. What do you think is the best way to handle this information, and would you be able to speak to Emin about it directly? I can also send this info to your father via Rona, but it is ultra-sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Best, Rob Goldstone.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that. I'm on the road at the moment, but perhaps I can just speak to Emin first. Seems we have some time, and if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer. Could we do a call first thing in the morning when I am back? Best, Don.
That is the key part of an email exchange between Donald Trump Jr. and music publicist Rob Goldstone. Trump Jr. released what he says is the whole exchange on Twitter today after being told the New York Times was about to publish it. The rest of the email exchange is about when and where they should meet. The meeting eventually took place a few days later at Trump Tower on June 9th of last year. Goldstone wasn't there, but a Russian lawyer named Natalia Veselnitskaya was, along with Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. The information offered in that meeting is unclear. Donald Trump Jr. has called it a nonsense meeting. Meanwhile, the House Intelligence Committee continues its investigation into Russian influence in the election. Burbank Congressman Adam Schiff is the top Democrat on that committee, and he joins us now from an Amtrak train to talk about this latest development. Hi.
It's good to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, hearing that exchange, reading those emails, what is your reaction?
Well, my first reaction is this is the Russian government acting through intermediaries to offer damaging information about Hillary Clinton in a way to influence the U.S. election in Donald Trump's favor. And this revelation comes after repeated denials by the president's son that he had any such meeting. And then when he was forced to admit he did have such a meeting, he claimed the meeting was about adoptions, and when he was confronted with the fact that, no, it was actually about something else, he had to acknowledge that. So it's been one series of shifting narratives after another, and I think this is quite a stunning development.
So after he was told of Russia's intent to help the Trump campaign in that email exchange, in your opinion, what would have been the best and correct response? What should he have said to Rob Goldstone?
Well, I think you should have said, we're not going to accept any foreign intervention or foreign help in this campaign. And I think he should have reported the outreach to the FBI that a foreign government was trying to interfere in a U.S. presidential election. That, I think, is a very serious potential intervention in our affairs, and that should have been reported to the proper authorities. It shouldn't have been responded to with a, I love it, and particularly late in the summer. Now, interestingly enough, late in the summer is when the Russians began dumping the stolen Hillary Clinton emails.
So in your view, is this collusion or incompetence?
Well, it certainly could be evidence of collusion. If you have a pattern of Russian outreach to the Trump campaign, individuals associated with the Trump campaign in coordinating in any way the dissemination of damaging information, that could be collusion. There's obviously a lot of work that needs to be done to determine what else we can about this meeting, what information they had in mind. Clearly, if this came from the what it was described as the Crown Prosecutor's father, someone connected within the Russian government, it then goes to someone considered to be the Donald Trump of Russia, and then to his son, and then to this intermediary, and then to our president's son. This is how the Russians do business. This is how the Russian government does business. They don't always use SVR agents. They often use oligarchs and other intermediaries. So we need to find out as much as we can about this and determine whether this is part of a broader pattern.
So who would you like to call now to testify?
Well, I think everyone connected with this meeting, we would have an interest in interviewing. So certainly the president's son, Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, the music promoter, If we're able to have a chance to interview the Russians involved in this, obviously be very interested in that, although we would have to take anything they said with an enormous grain of salt. But the documents also are very important.
What does it say to you, though, that Donald Trump Jr. in recent days has changed his story about what happened in that meeting?
Well, I think it's very telling because this is part of a much broader pattern of many people now associated with the Trump campaign, in this case, the very inner circle of the Trump organization and family, who have essentially told false accounts of first denied interaction, then told false accounts about what those interactions were really about. That, I think, speaks to their intent, an intent to conceal a knowledge potentially of wrongdoing. But it also means that we can't accept any representation coming out of this White House.
Do you think that any laws may have been broken here, any campaign laws or even treason?
Well, it's certainly possible that laws were violated. If there was an effort by the campaign to seek the assistance of a hostile foreign government, or really any foreign government, to, in effect, get an in-kind contribution of damaging information from the Russian government, you know, that very well could be criminal, and the crime would be conspiracy to violate our election laws. If there was any kind of quid pro quo, if they discussed in that meeting a willingness, for example, to do away with that Magnitsky Act, something that Putin really despised, that was a form of sanctions legislation that sanctioned Russian individuals for human rights violations, if there was an understanding that if they got the goods on Hillary, that this was a policy that President Trump would change, that obviously could be criminal as well.
Now, Donald Trump Jr. has said, well, he thought he was just getting some Oppo research, and that once he met with this lawyer, her statements were vague, ambiguous, made no sense, gave no details or supporting information, and that this meeting was basically a bust. Does that matter to you?
No, it doesn't. First of all, we can't trust the account that we were getting from the president's son because it has changed so many times. But more than that, we need to find out, was there follow-up after this meeting to get the information that was promised? But also, it demonstrates a clear willingness and intent to engage with the Russian government to obtain damaging information that would influence the election. That is deeply concerning at many levels. And of course, probably the most significant thing that we need to determine is the Russians are aware of these meetings because they were participants in these meetings. If there's other contacts and other material that the Russians are aware of that they can hold over the president's head, that can influence U.S. policy in ways that are not in U.S. interests. So whether that is knowledge of other meetings, knowledge of providing material to the campaign, knowledge of any coordination with the campaign, knowledge of any improper business dealings, either before or during the campaign, all of that is potentially compromising, what the Russians call kompromat. And among the most serious things we need to explore is to make sure that they don't have something that they can hold over this president that would affect our policy in Syria or our policy in Ukraine. So that, I think, is among the most significant things we need to determine.
Now, I understand your committee has issued some subpoenas and that Donald Trump Jr. is not on that list. Do you now want to add him to the list?
Well, we certainly will want to have him come into the committee. He hasn't been subpoenaed in part because we don't begin by subpoenaing our witnesses. We invite them to come voluntarily. If they don't come voluntarily and they have relevant information, then we do issue subpoenas. But we'll certainly make our efforts to obtain the help of any witnesses or information from any witnesses voluntarily.
Donald Trump Sr., the president, has said he didn't know anything about this meeting until recently. Do you believe that?
Well, here's the thing. The president said the other day that when he was meeting with Vladimir Putin, they did not discuss sanctions. And within 24 to 48 hours, his own press secretary said, actually, they did. So I'm not sure what we can rely on that the president says when it comes to Russia. So I think, again, we have to take whatever representations are made by the president or his family or his campaign with a very big grain of salt when it comes to Russia.
There have been bits of news coming out about Russia and the campaign for months now. And I'm wondering where you place this latest piece of news, these emails, in the whole array of news.
I think this is a very significant new development in terms of the public revelations, because here you have direct contact with a member of the president's inner circle, where you have an expression by the Russian government of a willingness to help elect Donald Trump and to provide something concrete, damaging information about Hillary Clinton. Now, we know from the timing of this meeting in June and the fact that damaging emails are released the following month, but those damaging emails have been obtained prior to this June meeting, that indeed the Russians did have damaging information that they could use and would in fact go on to use that damaging information about Hillary Clinton in the form of those stolen emails. So the timing is also significant. I'm particularly interested in the president's son's comments that he would be especially interested in this in late July, because that's, of course, when the dumping of the stolen material begins.
So he has said, as I mentioned earlier, that there was no information provided at this meeting. Do you think that they actually could have told Trump Jr. about these emails then in that meeting, and he's just not admitting that?
Well, I think anything is really possible, given that he has not been candid or forthcoming about anything about that meeting, and of course only divulged the emails when he knew the New York Times was going to publish them. So he knew all too well what that meeting was about. He was present at it. It's not something he forgot. He had the documentary evidence about what went into the setting up of that meeting, but nonetheless was willing to mislead the country about how it came about and what it was supposed to be about. Is it possible he's now still misleading the country about what was said? Of course, that's very possible.
In your conversations with your Republican colleagues, what's your sense in terms of how this is playing out on the other side of the aisle?
You know, I haven't had a chance to talk with them in the last 24 to 48 hours. But I think on a very bipartisan basis, people are deeply concerned with the president's Russia policy and their profound questions about why he has that policy. And I think there's a willingness to investigate and determine whether there's something improper or illicit that has gone on or is going on. There's not much of a willingness at times to be public about that on the GOP side, but I think there's ample concern, and it's why the sanctions legislation in the Senate passed 97-2. And it's certainly my hope that that legislation will be taken up in the House so that we can ensure that the sanctions that were put in place over Russia's interference in our election and our invasion of Ukraine are not unilaterally removed by the president.
Congressman, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's California Congressman Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Well, if politics is getting too intense and you'd rather crawl into a corner and wait for the coming apocalypse, take along the current issue of New York Magazine. The cover story by David Wallace Wells paints the bleakest possible picture of climate change. Imagine a world so hot humans can't breathe, leading to carbon-induced brain confusion. Not to mention food shortage, disease, cities disappearing. It's the doom and gloom of your worst nightmares, and it has provoked a backlash online. Danielle Aldana Cohen studies climate politics and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He calls the piece disaster porn. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Okay, disaster porn. What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess what I mean is that this is a story in New York Magazine that paints this incredibly gruesome picture of the effects of climate change in a very unrealistic and exaggerated way that is really more of a kind of fantasy of what could happen under a whole series of circumstances, pretty implausible. And I think that that fact of it being a fantasy that really is kind of meant to shock us but doesn't have much of a relationship to reality, to me that feels a bit like disaster porn.
Right. He says he interviewed tons and tons of scientists and read lots of research papers and says, well, this is not going to happen necessarily, but could happen if we don't do anything. So he says, you know, this is the worst case scenario. Would you agree with that at least?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that there's often, unfortunately, still in discussions of climate change, there's this attitude that the kind of purest, most solid truth is just the climate science itself. I think if you look at where the conversation is right now in terms of the actual politics of climate change, what's likely to happen, you have to look at the kind of atmospheric chemistry, the circulation of the ocean, all of that, but also conversations about economics, also conversations about social inequality and how people are dealing with that. And you want to really think of it as like a stool. And those are the, you know, those are the legs of the stool, the economics, the social inequality, the science, the kind of pure science itself. If you take one of those legs out from the stool, the story just kind of collapses. It's not actually a realistic portrayal of what's going on or of what's likely to develop.
Because of all the things that are being done right now to mitigate the effects of climate change?
That's right. Yeah, I think where we are right now is there is beginning a massive clean energy transition. I think it's a bit hard to see in the United States right now with the news coming out of Washington, but it's still happening all over the country. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in China. We're also getting now increasingly action to deal with the effects of climate change. And to me, the questions are, yeah, one, are we moving fast enough? But also, two, you know, who's benefiting in the short term from these transformations? Who's gonna have to pay the price? And I think those are the really big questions going forward. Can you build a broad coalition around equitable climate politics that kind of really meets the aspirations of most people? Or is climate policy going to feel like something that is done for like affluent white urban liberals? And then you get this huge kind of backlash, as I think we've seen politically in this country in the last year, and that makes it very hard to move forward. So, you know, to me, the question isn't like what's going to happen to a glacier in 60 years. The question right now is like what is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years in terms of big changes in the economy and politics and society around climate change. And, you know, what's really scary to me is the prospect that climate change gets branded as this like urban, affluent, white, liberal kind of special interest. That, I think, is the biggest danger, and not, you know, projecting decades ahead as if all the stuff that's happening now weren't happening.
Right. Well, I guess the argument in favor of an article like this is that you need something like that to wake up people, voters and policymakers, to, in fact, put these policies into effect that you're talking about that would change the way that we look at climate change when it comes from a political standpoint or an economic standpoint, and that it's really hard to get people interested when you talk about, oh, a 2 degrees Celsius increase. People don't really understand the significance of something like that. But when you're talking about New York City becoming as hot as Bahrain, people can really wrap their minds around that.
Yeah, you know, I don't entirely dispute that, but the thing is that the social psychology shows that if you want to reach a lot of people, the doom and gloom stuff does tend to shut people down. I think we all have a kind of different Facebook wall, obviously, but what I'm seeing in reaction to this piece is a lot of, oh, you know, we're just screwed. It really is kind of over. And that's not true. And the climate scientist Michael Mann, I think, led the pushback from the climate science community saying, look, the climate science shows that there is still time to turn this around. We know from the economists, from the engineers, we know from the social scientists that there is still time for this like big transformation that's already taken hold to really, really transform, you know, our use of energy, and decarbonize the economy. I don't know if, to be honest, you know, your kind of ordinary person is really being scared into action by this kind of thing. I think inspiring people with real opportunities for jobs in the clean energy economy, you know, the solar economy grew 17 times faster than the economy as a whole last year. To me, that's really good news. We know how to retrofit homes so that they, you know, it's much cheaper to heat them or to cool them. There are all these kinds of ways that you can fight racism and poverty and climate change at the same time. And I think that kind of story does help you build the coalition. And that's actually a much more helpful way to talk than to just, again, have these kind of pure fantasies of the worst thing that could possibly happen. I mean, I'm not saying that nobody should talk about where some of the dimensions of the climate science out at that time scale. I just don't think it's, to be honest, a very realistic portrait of the dangers and the opportunities ahead of us. And that for that to kind of be seizing and leading the conversation, to me, is really politically dangerous.
Mm. But what about, how are we supposed to read what scientists say? Because he writes in his piece that scientists, there's a timid language of scientific probabilities. That's what he calls it. And he cites James Hansen, the famous climatologist, who has called, the science community out for scientific reticence, chastising scientists for editing their own observations so conscientiously that people don't really think that the threat is dire. So how are we to read scientific assessments when scientists are by nature cautious?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. There's no doubt that in the last 15 years, the more kind of pessimistic perspectives on things like sea level rise have been vindicated as the science is improving. So it's certainly not the case that I am advocating, or I think anyone is really advocating, that you take this overly optimistic interpretation of the science. And actually, in most cases, you know, the science that we're reading tends to be a kind of conservative summary of stuff that is a few years old. So, you know, I think we do have to look ahead and note that there's a huge amount of risk at the far end in terms of how bad things can get. At the same time, if you look back 10 years ago at projections for renewable energy development, solar, wind turbines, we're blowing through those. We're blowing through this. Solar and wind are getting way cheaper, way faster than anybody predicted. And in terms of political change, you know, when you look at the last election, you look at the primaries with, you know, the rise of Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, Donald Trump on the Republican side, there's a huge amount of political unpredictability. So, again, I think to just fetishize, just focus on certain aspects of the science gives you a very narrow perspective on what the future of climate politics looks like. And if you look at the full picture in terms of the energy transition, in terms of a huge portfolio of policies that are available right now to tackle inequality and climate change at the same time, to me, the overwhelming balance of evidence is that we can be cautiously optimistic and we have a huge amount to win here. And it really is possible to make progress quickly.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right. Daniel Aldana Cohen, he studies climate politics and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Okay, we want to hear from you. Do you think that scare tactics are what we need when it comes to fighting climate change? Do doomsday scenarios make you more or less motivated to care about this issue? You can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why we humans may have a better sense of smell than we think. There's new research next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are a lot of explanations out there for why humans have a poor sense of smell. Allegedly have a poor sense of smell, that is. One, as humans began walking upright, smell became less important than sight. Two, we're more logical creatures, so we don't need to rely on our sense of smell to direct our behavior. And number three, overall, our sight is just more powerful than our sense of smell. Well, it turns out that all three of those explanations are wrong. More and more scientists are finding that our sense of smell is way more powerful than we thought. And for more now, I'm joined by one researcher, John McCann, who has studied our sense of smell extensively. He's an associate professor of neuroscience and psychology at Rutgers University. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, where did these ideas that we have a poor sense of smell come from?
So they hit a real moment in the 19th century with a famous neuroanatomist named Paul Broca. Broca was a neurosurgeon. He was actually very interested in understanding the language deficits that happen in people after a stroke. A lot of people have heard of Broca's aphasia, which is a kind of language problem that happens. And he was also interested in understanding what made humans different and special compared to other animals. He was interested in free will, and he thought that humans were different because we could decide how we went about our business and how we responded to stimuli in the environment. And he was really struck by the development, the evolution, I guess, of the frontal cortex, the frontal lobe of the human brain, which is huge compared to most other mammals. And he was also struck by the fact that the human olfactory system didn't get sort of proportionately bigger. It remained relatively small from an evolutionary perspective while the rest of the brain got bigger. And he thought that made sense because he thought of smell as this sort of animalistic sense that compelled behavior, right? Smells made animals have sex with each other and things like that. And humans, of course, had free will and could decide not to respond to certain smells like that. So he had this idea that in order for us to develop free will in the frontal lobe of the brain, we had to lose our sense of smell, or at least lose the ability of the smell to force us to do things. So his work was actually picked up and sort of propagated through the years by a couple of different directions. A lot of biologists, of course, sort of followed Broca's lead, and over the course of the 20th century, there was sort of this long list of famous biologists and neuroscientists who sort of said, oh, you know, smell's not very important in humans, so we're not going to worry about it. But it was also picked up by Sigmund Freud. Everyone knows Freud is this famous psychologist, but he trained as a physician, and his original book was actually about aphasia, the damage that happens in the brain after a stroke and how it influences smell. And so he was really familiar with Broca's work. And Freud really sort of bought into Broca's idea about the human sense of smell being very weak. And he thought that, well, maybe what makes humans different is that we can develop mental illnesses. And he wanted to understand mental illness in humans and say, well, you know what? Maybe what happened is that to become human, we had to put our animalness aside and we had to become this sort of special, rational, upright being. And that smell was sort of this vestigial animalistic sense to Freud. And so he actually thought that people who really took pleasure from their sense of smell were at risk for mental illness. He thought it was a sign of neurosis.
Hmm. Okay, so what proof is there that our sense of smell isn't as bad as we think?
So there's been a lot of work on human olfaction over many, many years, and there's been a fair bit of work recently directly comparing what can a human smell compared to a mouse, compared to a monkey. So I have actually a colleague in Sweden named Mattias Laska who's made tremendous strides doing these sorts of experiments, and he's found that it really depends on the odor.
So it's not necessarily that one animal has a better sense of smell than the other. It's that one animal has a better sense of smell for certain properties, certain ingredients than another animal.
That's exactly right. The sort of joking way I've been putting it is if you want an animal to smell a fire hydrant and tell you who's peed there, you probably want a dog. But if you want someone to pick out a wine for dinner, you probably don't want a dog.
But, okay, that gets at the dog's taste level, though. I'm sure the dog can still smell wine, right?
Well, sure. But certainly it's the case that people tend to underestimate the importance of smell in their lives because we don't tend to realize that most of what we call taste is really smell. Like if you put food in your mouth and you chew on it, of course you're going to get the sweet, sour, salty, bitter sort of meatiness flavors from the actual from your taste system. But most of what you'd actually perceive is actually smell. It's called retronasal smell, where the odor goes up the back of your throat and into your nose, which is why you may notice that foods don't taste as good when you have a really bad head cold because the airflow doesn't happen normally. So if you think about all of the things that influence our behavior in terms of food and cooking and going to nice restaurants, and you think about all the different products that we have to shop for and all of the real and imagined influences that those fragrances can have on our behavior, I think you start to realize that human smell is a really big deal.
Are there some humans who can smell a lot better than others? In other words, there are super tasters. Are there super smellers?
It sort of depends on what you define as normal. So I'll start by saying that there are certainly trained perfumers and folks in the wine industry who have practiced and trained, and they do in fact develop their sense of smell to some extent. They get a little bit better at discriminating mixtures of compounds that have been, once you get above, a modest number of chemicals mixed together, most people can't tell you what's in the mixture anymore, and perfumers can usually get a couple more things into the mix before they become unable to tell. But there are lots of differences from person to person naturally. So, on average, women have a better sense of smell than men. They're more sensitive to most odors. They're better at discriminating similar odors across the board. And there are some folks who, for various reasons, are born with little or no sense of smell, or they've lost it through an upper respiratory infection or a car accident. So there really is quite a range. It's difficult to say if there's anybody who's been sort of a true master, right? Maybe if you think back in history, you can get back to someone like Ernest Beau, who invented Chanel No. 5 as a perfumer 100 years ago. And I guess that's pretty good if they're still working on that perfume 100 years later. But it's hard to say for sure.
So what is the problem of not prioritizing smell, that we think that we don't have a good sense of smell in general?
You know, there's a practical side to it, which is that over the last 100 years, we've put a huge amount of effort into understanding blindness and therapies for the blind or for the deaf. And by and large, I think there's just sort of many years behind in trying to understand the causes and potential therapies of smell loss, which we're now appreciating not just influences your smell, but it affects your eating, it affects your taste, it affects overall happiness. There's links to depression. There's really quite a lot of medical side effects and complications that I think we're really at the early days of figuring out. And it would be much better if we put the resources and the time into trying to help folks who've lost their sense of smell, and at the very least to sort of validate that this is an important loss and not a minor thing that we should just say, you know, don't worry about it.
How's your sense of smell?
You know, I used to say my sense of smell was really good. But when you work in an olfactory laboratory, it's kind of humbling because there's definitely folks in my laboratory who've got a better sense of smell than I do. I'm pretty good, but there's a lot of people I know that are better than me.
Okay. John McGann, Associate Professor of Neuroscience and Psychology at Rutgers University. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, Christine Pelisek, the reporter who broke the grim sleeper serial killer story, says she wrote the book to give the victims in South LA a voice.
You know, these women, the cases just weren't solved. And so these serial killers, it was like a playground for them. They could just kill and not have to worry about it.
How the case was solved, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Christine Pelisek was doing what good crime reporters do. Back in January of 2006, she was chatting up a source at the LA coroner's office, checking on murders over the weekend. He mentioned that there had been a large number of body dumping cases in recent years. He had a list. Pelisek wanted it. She eventually got that list, and after years of work, she broke the story of a serial killer in South Central LA.
In Southern California today, an accused serial murderer is facing justice after a decades-long mystery that has terrified areas of Los Angeles. The so-called Grim Sleeper trial.
Tonight we've learned the Los Angeles police has been flooded with phone calls, emails, and visits to their website after these faces were published on the front page of the Los Angeles Times.
Police believe that Lonnie Franklin Jr. murdered at least 10 people, all African-American women from South Central Los Angeles, beginning in 1985.
Christine Pelisek explains how she broke the story in her new book. It's called The Grim Sleeper, The Lost Women of South Central. She talks about the investigation and the trial of Lonnie Franklin, the man eventually convicted of many of the killings. Pelisek also digs into the lives of the women who were killed. The names on that list at the coroner's office.
The list was 38 women, and they were killed all over L.A. County. So there was, and there was all different law enforcement agencies involved, too. There was like Inglewood, LAPD, L.A. County Sheriff, like all of them. And so what I did was I contacted each of the law enforcement agencies to find out if any of the cases were connected. And, you know, some of the detectives, you know, they were actually surprised that I was calling them because, you know, some of the girls on the list had, you know, prostitution histories. Mm-hmm. And so it was uncommon for them to get calls from reporters who were interested in, you know, girls that had drug histories and prostitution. But they were very open to talk about the cases.
And at that point, were you thinking there was a serial killer?
I didn't know. I mean, in the back of my head, I thought, maybe there is. Because there was a lot of African-American women that were killed in South Los Angeles. And some of their deaths were very, you know, they were similar. So I was going through talking to the detectives, asking them, do you think these cases are connected? And they were like, you know, we don't know. We're waiting for DNA. Possibly they might be connected, you know. But it wasn't until I got to the number 37 on the list, Princess Berthemieu. And she was a 15-year-old runaway. And she was found dead in an alleyway in Inglewood. She was nude. You know, she had been strangled. And I contacted the Inglewood Police Department at that point, you know, wanting to find out about her death. And so I bugged the detective, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks, and he finally agreed to meet with me. And I went there and met with him, and he actually told me that Princess's case, you know, the number 37 on my list, was connected to my number 38 case, which was Valerie McCorvey, and that was an LAPD case. And that was a 35-year-old woman, you know, mother of two, who died. She was strangled to death, her body dumped on the street, literally on the street in South Los Angeles. And she was, you know, she had a prostitution history. And those two cases were linked to a series of murders that occurred back in the 80s, from 1985 to 1988.
And how were those linked?
Those cases in the 80s were linked through ballistics. But in 2001, the LAPD started a cold case unit and started looking back at all the old murders and putting the evidence in for DNA testing. And so it turned out that some of the victims in the 80s ended up being linked to Princess and Valerie through DNA.
So you do your reporting and you talk about this serial killer who is linked to these murders in the 80s and these more recent murders in the early 2000s. And what's happening with the investigation and what's happening in the community?
Well, after I did a couple of stories, but after what happened was Princess Berthemieu was killed in 2002. Janethia Peters was killed in 2003. The LAPD starts looking into the case. But the detective that was working on the case, you know, he also had other serial killer cases that he was working on back in the 80s, like Chester Turner, Michael Hughes. There were also two other serial killers.
Why were there so many serial killers operating in the 80s?
It's hard to say. I don't know. But they're all operating in this like 51 square mile area. You know, and it's just bizarre. I don't know. Maybe it was easier to pick up people back then, you know, because of the crack epidemic, you know, and there were so many murders going on. You know, the police, you know, had their hands full.
So they were investigating gang murders and drive-bys and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So it was hard. I think that the women, because of the fact that they were so involved with those type of murders, the gang murders, the drive-by murders, that the women were neglected. And so I think that that's part of the reason why, you know, the cases weren't solved. I mean, I think that the detectives tried as hard as they could to a certain degree. But I mean, they had so many cases constantly. You'd on a weekend, they'd have like three homicides. And so they'd spend, you know, maybe a day with one case and then they'd have to move on to another one. You know, so, you know, these women, the cases just weren't solved. And so these serial killers, it was like a playground for them. They could just kill and not have to worry about it.
And so Lonnie Franklin, he felt that he could operate with impunity. Here he was, a member of the very community that he was terrorizing. He was out and about helping people fix their cars. He was considered kind of a friendly neighbor by a lot of people.
Yes, he lived in the epicenter of where all the murders took place. Like most of the killings, the bodies were dumped along Western Avenue, and he lived on 81st and Western. Like he was just, you know, sometimes like less than a mile away where he dumped some of his victims. And he was really popular in the neighborhood. I mean, all his friends, they all said that he was like this really great guy. One of his neighbors said that he was such a chatterbox and like just he loved to gossip in the neighborhood. One of his friends said that he used to call him Lonnie Anderson, you know, after the WKRP star.
Yeah.
You know, because he literally stopped people on the street, like his friends, and want to gossip. You know, he didn't keep to himself. He liked to talk. He loved to show his neighbors, his male friends, photos of his women, he'd like to call them. Because he'd have, like, he was married. He was a grandfather. He had a couple of his own kids. But he had numerous girlfriends, and he spent a lot of time with prostitutes. And he'd take photos of these girls and he'd show them, you know, to his friends. And he'd have these, you know, different names, you know, for these girls. He'd call like Big Butt and, you know, My Girl and, you know, and he'd always show his friends all these photos.
And these are not girls he ended up killing.
Well, some of the, well, it's hard to say what happened, you know, like in the situations when he picked up some of these girls. But I mean, a lot of his friends had said that, you know, he'd pick up girls all the time, you know, and he'd have a wife, he'd have a girlfriend, and he'd be picking up girls.
So what would make one person escape and be fine with her life and the other person become a victim? Well, what was his MO?
Well, a lot of the detectives that I talked to think that, you know, I don't, and I also agree with this too. Like, I think that he killed the women that talked back to him. You know, I think that anyone who fought him, he killed.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Christine Pelisek, the author of The Grim Sleeper, The Lost Women of South Central. She broke the story of The Grim Sleeper. And what is your take on the LAPD at that time? Could they have done more? Could they have, as you said, they were operating in the midst of the crack cocaine crisis and their resources were stretched thin. Could they have done more at the time?
Well, I think that the problem the detectives had back in the 80s, too, was the fact that they had no DNA, right? Today, police are so lucky because they have the DNA.
And that's how this case was solved.
And this is how this case was solved. This case was solved through familial DNA testing. They actually found, you know, his son. He was arrested through his son who had an arrest like the year before. But I think it was very difficult for those detectives. It was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. And back in the 80s, there was over 1,000 murders a year in South Los Angeles. And in, like, for example, 77th Division, which is a division within South Los Angeles, they had like seven or eight detectives handling like 130, 140 cases a year. So they were stretched thin. There were also the fact that there were so many serial killers operating. I mean, they did have a task force back then, and they were able to actually solve two of the serial killer cases. But the Lonnie Franklin case, which they didn't talk about at all in the press back in the 80s, was something that they just couldn't, you know, they couldn't do it. I mean, I think the detectives tried, but, you know, mm-hmm. I think it was just, it was too difficult a case to solve, I think.
So then the trial takes forever, takes years to get him convicted for various reasons. He's finally convicted. He's given the death penalty. And he still has not admitted that he did any of these murders, right?
Right.
He still maintains his innocence.
That's right.
And the family members, have they been able to move on?
No, the family members. I mean, I think that there was some closure for the family members. But I mean, a lot of the family members, I mean, they had waited for over 20 years for justice. And a lot of the family members didn't think that the police did enough, you know, back in the 80s. And so so throughout, it was just, it's been a painful experience for them. And so, I mean, I think that they're glad that it's over because, you know, some of the family members went, like, literally, there was hearings every 2 weeks, and they would go to every single hearing, and sometimes the hearings only lasted for 5 minutes. You know, it was one of the things that I really, after when the guilty verdict, when the look on the family members' faces were just amazing, you know, they were all, everyone was crying, but finally, you know, they finally got the justice. It was just like it was such an amazing moment to see that, you know.
Gratifying for you.
It was gratifying for me, but it was more so just for the families because I felt so bad for the families how they had to wait for so long, you know, and to finally have it over with, you know, and they could kind of go on with their lives. Because, I mean, Mary Alexander, Monique Alexander's mother, she, you know, like, this whole thing destroyed her, you know? And her son said that during the trial, he could see her getting her spark back, you know, her feisty attitude back, you know? So it was good to see that because, you know, this case, like, destroyed her. It didn't just destroy the victims, but it destroyed all the family members.
The book is called Grim Sleeper, The Lost Women of South Central by Christine Pelisek. Christine, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up, why some fancy East Coast chefs are setting their sights on Los Angeles and why the favor is not being returned by fancy LA chefs. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles is being invaded, not by screenwriters or tech startups or aspiring YouTubers. That already happened. No, it's being invaded by East Coast chefs and restaurateurs. The owners of New York's famed 11 Madison Park are opening the Nomad Hotel downtown later this year. They already have a food truck that pops up around town. Momofuku's dessert chain Milk Bar has named a location for its L.A. expansion, and they join Bauhaus in Chinatown and Georgie in Beverly Hills, both of which opened last year. Here to tell us all about this influx and what, if anything, it means for our food scene is food writer Josh Scherer. Hi.
Hey, thank you for having me, and thank you for discussing this very pressing invasion with me. I think it is a very important topic.
Should we be alarmed? Is this like a Martian invasion?
I think we should be alarmed. I think we should be really interested because there are like three possible outcomes, right? Like the first of which is all these New York restaurants come here and they completely flop and everyone hates them. And then our sense as Angelenos is totally reaffirmed. And then like we all high five together
superior.
Venice Boulevard or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Or they come in and they just like completely revolutionize everything. And we're like, oh my God, we were missing a $48 roast chicken.
Yeah.
And then there's the thing that's actually going to happen, which is some of them are going to succeed and then some of them are going to fail. And then largely nothing is going to change. That said, I'm still really excited to see what the outcome is because we've never seen like this concentration of chefs just flocking to LA at this time.
And why are they coming here?
I think it's a few reasons. I think LA, people are starting to finally realize the like total objective coolness of it. And I think part of it is that a lot of the like ranking systems have totally avoided LA. Like we have nothing on the world's 50 best list. The Michelin guide they haven't come here in like 11 years. So when everyone refers to anything in LA as like two Michelin starred blah, that means literally nothing anymore. They haven't even been here in over a decade. Or even the James Beard Awards, we get snubbed absolutely every year.
Yeah.
And I think that like general neglect by like this hierarchical power just made us super cool. But in this specific case, I think you're seeing a couple things happen. Some of these restaurants are opening in hotels.
Mm-hmm.
You see Georgie with Iron Chef Jeffrey Zakarian. I think legally you have to say Iron Chef in front of his name now. Not sure how that works with Food Network. But he opened in the Montage Hotel in Beverly Hills, where Scarpetta previously was. They have a chicken Caesar salad that costs $31 at lunch.
Wow.
Before tax and tip, of course. So you want a chicken Caesar, you're going to drop $42-ish.
I hope it's free range or whatever.
Oh, yeah. You know the chicken's name. They give you a photo. You can choose to like adopt one of their kids afterwards or something.
That's a Portlandia episode you're talking about.
Well, it's coming by way of New York to Beverly Hills. So some of these, I think, are tied up in big development deals. So the Waldorf Astoria opened. They brought in Jean-Georges Vongerichten, where if you have that many syllables in your name, you better be good at something.
Props to you for pronouncing that correctly.
Thank you so much. I practiced a couple times. He opened three separate concepts within this hotel. One of the concepts, you have to be a guest at the hotel to even get into. So like us normies can't even go there to get their... I think they have a $30 cheeseburger in one of their things, and they run the whole room service situation. So there's not a lot of risk if you're a really established chef coming in and being in a big hotel contract, which is where something like Bauhaus or even the Nomad, which is part of a hotel, but the restaurant is kind of really inextricable from it. They seem to really trying to be establishing a sense of place in LA with the food truck and collaborating with other chefs, and I think that's super cool. It's like they're showing it's like a gesture of supplication in a way.
And speaking of the food truck, there is an item there, right, that you actually like, the hot dog that you spend a small fortune on, but it's worth it?
A small fortune hot dog. I mean, if you're going to pay, it should be called that. I think it's the hashtag, maybe. But I mean, if you're spending $31 on a chicken Caesar salad from a New York chef, you might as well spend like $8 on a hot dog from a truck. But it is incredible. And it's an item I think they only developed for this LA food truck. It's a bacon-wrapped hot dog, and it's like just super buttery brioche split-top bun. There's like a black truffle celery relish on it and just this like super creamy aioli. And it's incredible. And it's, the chef showing you like I'm here. I understand, you know, what you guys want, or at least I'm trying to show you that I want to understand. I'm, you know, invoking like the praise of the godfathers of LA's already very established food scene. And like, I want to kind of bow down and, you know, be deferential to that, where it's, you know, literally the opposite of throwing a $31 Caesar salad on a menu.
Right. And so I think that the brioche helps with that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of key.
Oh, yeah.
If you put anything in a brioche.
I agree with that, too. Yeah.
Okay. So there's that food truck and it kind of roams around. It's a nomad.
It is, yeah.
I suppose.
Makes more sense in the actual restaurant.
Yeah. And so then they're going to have this 11 Madison Park. Is that going to be a fancy restaurant?
Yeah. So the restaurant is almost kind of a bistro adaptation of 11 Madison Park is the way I understand it in New York. And they're really famous for this like big bombastic roast chicken dish. They stuff truffles under the skin and all that. And it's supposed to be absolutely perfect. And so I think it's something that could fit in really, really well because I've eaten a lot of roast chickens in LA and none of them have like ever been close to impressing me.
Okay. So what about the reverse? LA chefs going to New York to colonize New York. Is that happening?
I don't think it's going to happen at all. It's like, I don't know, why would like geese fly to a colder location in the winter? You know, like that doesn't...
Well, because then they could get their Michelin star or they could get a James Beard Award. I don't know.
I don't think they give geese Michelin star. No, you know, we haven't really seen the same thing at all. And I don't necessarily know what the exact reason is. I think a lot of it is in LA, it is just objectively easier to open a restaurant. I think the one restaurant that we now see opening up in New York as like LA's cultural culinary ambassador is Egg Slut. So like maybe they're starting the trend and some radio station in New York is going to be like, why are all these LA chefs coming here in a couple of months? But you really don't see the opposite. And I think a lot of it is, you know, LA, much more chill vibe and Michelin stars and all that really don't mean that much anymore.
Food writer Josh Scherer, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, that'll do it for us. If you want to reach out about anything you've heard on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Facebook, same thing, at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.